shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening, this is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries, welcoming you to another one of our first of the month Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We're being heard tonight over radio station WWCR on both transmitters 3 and 4. That's 4.840 megahertz and 5.890 megahertz. And shortwave station WBCQ at 7.490 megahertz. Both of those stations do have internet links, but by the time you hear this broadcast, it will already be posted on our radio archives page. You can go to kingidentity.com, go to our radio archives page, and you can listen to any of our back broadcasts, including this broadcast tonight. The reason for that is that due to my guest schedule, this program is being pre-recorded, so there won't be any phone calls to the program tonight. Tonight, we're doing a program on a subject that a number of you have requested, and that is the so-called Holocaust. My guest is an author, historian, world traveler, scholar, director of the Institute of Historical Review, and an expert on tonight's subject. I'd like to welcome back to the broadcast, Mark Weber.
Thank you very much, Mike, for having me on. I especially appreciate that you've recorded this session to take into account my schedule. I would have liked to have been with you for a live broadcast, but that's just not possible because I have other obligations I have. So I appreciate you making this, being flexible in this way for tonight. But I'm glad to be on with you. I've enjoyed the sessions we've had in the past.
Well, we enjoy having you on and appreciate you pre-recording this broadcast. Before we start tonight's topic, I'd be interested in your thoughts concerning the recent election.
Well, this is a very historic election, I think, Mike, for a lot of reasons. This is the first time in American history that a man has been elected president who has no record of service in public life as in politics or in military life. America has never done that before. Every president that we have, the American people have elected in the past has always been either a senator, a governor, has had some sort of important position in the government, or he's been an important military figure. Donald Trump is the first person to be elected who has a role only in business life, not in politics or military. But more than that, a man like Donald Trump would not have been considered electable 20 years ago or 30 years ago or certainly 40 years ago for numerous reasons, just culturally or just by his behavior. Certainly, I mean, there was a time when I was young that it was considered impossible that a man who had been divorced could be elected president. And certainly someone who has the behavior and the of Donald Trump would have been unthinkable 30, 40 years ago. And in that sense, Donald Trump's election is a reflection of just how cultural standards and standards of conduct so have changed in America, I think for the worst, over the last 30, 40 years. But more than that, this election, I think, is important because never before in American history have so many Americans been unhappy with the choice presented by the major parties. That is, both candidates registered very high negatives with the public. We've had very contentious and emotional election campaigns in the past, but Americans have always said, well, they might hate one candidate, but they liked another. In this election, very large numbers of Americans dislike both candidates. And many of those who voted for Donald Trump in this election did so not because they so much like Donald Trump, but because they loathe and are contemptuous of what Hillary Clinton was and what she stood for. By the same token, many people voted for Hillary Clinton in this election because they fear and hate what Donald Trump stands for. And that's a society, that's a reflection of a society in very, very great problems, because there's just fundamental disagreement and unhappiness about the nature of about American society. When typically in American history, candidates did not ever suggest that the other candidate was unfit to be president. John Kennedy never said that Richard Nixon was unfit to be president, or Eisenhower never thought that Adlai Stevenson or so forth was unfit to be president. But in this election campaign, each of the candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, repeatedly claimed that the alternative, the opponent, was unfit even to be president. Now, this is all an expression of a society with very, very grave problems. And the problems are really fundamental problems about what America is as a country, what kind of country this is. And that's one of the reasons why this is a very historic election campaign. And of course, it's also historic because it was so surprising that Donald Trump would be elected in spite of the predictions. And more than that, in spite of tremendous opposition from the intellectual establishment, most of the media, and even leaders of his, many leaders of his own party. And that's all a reflection of a society in very, very serious turmoil and discord that America is today, I think.
Well, of course, a lot of the hope on the right over the years that I've been following elections have been defeated. And Trump is the first one that's been elected. I mean, Buchanan went by the wayside, George Wallace, and so on. I think the people are anticipating a lot that's probably not going to take place. I realized that Ronald Reagan, there was a great hope for a lot of people, but Ronald Reagan really wasn't a good man. I think the positive things he accomplished, which were limited, was probably due to a lot of the advisors that he had. And I think Trump will probably be the same way. A lot will depend on the people that he has in cabinet posts and other positions to advise him.
One of the remarkable things about the Donald Trump campaign is that Donald Trump and his supporters acknowledge that America is in big trouble. Not just it has economic troubles, but America is not even a great country. When Donald Trump's slogan that he repeated over and over was said, "Make America Great Again," he says America is not a great country. That's already a remarkable thing. Previously in American history, there have been times when Americans were unhappy about conditions in the Great Depression, or there have been other problems, but this is the first time that I know of, certainly in modern times, that an American, that someone's been elected who says that the country is not even a great country. And on the Democratic side, when after Donald Trump would make that statement, Hillary Clinton would respond by saying, America's a great country and always has been great. Whereas within her own party, then, many people say, no, America has always been a bad country because it's been a country of oppression, of racism, and so forth. But Donald Trump is one of those striking things is very, very few people that I talk to who supported Donald Trump were able to articulate very well, including Donald Trump, what he means by a great country. He means a country not only that's prosperous, but confident of itself. But a country that's confident in itself is a country with a firm identity of itself. And Donald Trump and American political leaders across the board, I think, don't have a clear idea even of what America is. If they want America to be the kind of country it used to be, it was a country in which it was a much more clearly European or white identity than certainly it is today. And Donald Trump got the support of many people who are unhappy with the changes that have been taking place racially and demographically in America, but are afraid or unwilling or unable to be explicit about that aspect of the thing. And Donald Trump himself, of course, emphasized over and over that he's a candidate and a president for all Americans, and that race simply doesn't matter. He said that repeatedly, but many of his supporters voted for him with the idea in a vague sort of way that America could go back to the kind of country it used to be when the population was more a white one, I think.
I guess we'll have to look forward and see what he does. I tell people that I'll praise him where he does right and condemn him where he does wrong, but one thing I'm afraid of is he will have to, well, I'm not afraid of this, that he has to keep some of his promises, because some of his promises I think were good. But I think that the international bankers and their cohorts may cause a purposeful recession, depression, as they did in the late 20s and 30s, and blame it on him for his good policies, not anything that he may do wrong. So I'm anticipating perhaps a financial crisis to come during his
administration. Well, many people voted for Trump based upon things he said, but they paid attention to things that he said that they liked to hear and ignored things that he said that they don't like to hear. Donald Trump was astonishingly inconsistent throughout his campaign, but he's already made clear, even before he's elected, before he takes office, that he's going to walk away from at least some of the promises he made during the campaign. He's already said that, contrary to what he said during the campaign, he's not going to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate and prosecute Hillary Clinton, the way he said during the campaign. He's walked away from other promises as well, and I expect that that's going to happen even more strikingly after he takes office. But more than that, Donald Trump said conflicting things during the campaign. He said, for example, that he wants an America First foreign policy, but he also said that he's 100% supportive of Israel. When a candidate is 100% supportive of any foreign country, particularly Israel, he cannot have a foreign policy that is America first. 100% devotion to Britain or to France or to Israel or to Pakistan or any country means that its policy, that the policy of this country cannot be a real America first one. Now, we don't know what this is all going to, how it's all going to turn out, because Donald Trump has given conflicting signals about a lot of things. It's unclear what he's going to do about the Affordable Health Care Act, so-called Obamacare. Sometimes he indicates that he was going to get rid of it. Other times he was going to, the critique he made specifically about it were rather minor criticisms in a way. He has never said he's against a national health care plan in and of itself. But, we'll see what happens. The bigger point, though, is that America is not going to be the country it was during the 1950s and 60s because it's changed in very fundamental ways over the last 40, 50 years, not only internally, but it's in relationship to the rest of the world. America, if you're over the age of 50, say, you'll remember when America had a much more potent and important presence in the world. But that's changed because America's role in the world, financially and economically, has become less important relative to that of other countries. China is now a major economic power in a way that it was not 40 years ago. There's America's just role in the world is not what it was in the years after World War II, when the rest of the world was still in ruins from the end of the Second World War. In addition, America has changed very dramatically over the last 40, 50 years, demographically and racially. California, where I live, has changed more drastically over the last 30 years or 40 years than Poland or Hungary or Romania did under 40 years of Soviet rule or Soviet domination. As important as the Soviet domination of much of Eastern Europe was, when it ended, Poland and Hungary and Romania and so forth went back to being Polish or Hungarian or Romanian. But Southern California has changed in a fundamental way, in the way that New York used to be a land where Indians were, and that's no longer the case, and it's changed. And, one of the most dramatic differences is after the end of the Second World War, Detroit was the industrial powerhouse of the American car industry. I don't think any reasonable person or aware person thinks that now Detroit, which is an overwhelmingly black city, is ever going to once again be the center of American industrial might the way it was in the 1940s and 50s. Anyway, these are reasons why the situation is very different, and many people are voted for Donald Trump hoping that he'll make some major differences. I'm very dubious about that because the forces that have made behind these changes have not been changed, and Donald Trump has offered no prospect that he's going to deal with those fundamental problems.
Well, also the parties, like the Republican Party, conservative meant people like Taft in foreign policy, but nowadays you've got the neocons, and some of them Trump intends to appoint. Of course, they push for things like war against Iran, and you never know if he's going to be influenced by these appointees. Probably will.
Well, Donald Trump seems to be a man who makes up his own mind. He doesn't listen, I think, very closely to others. Maybe he will as president. But one of the things that was very appealing, I think, for many people was that he spoke off the top of his head, and that gave at least the impression that he's not a scripted, bought and paid for politician like others have been. He's not a Mitt Romney or a Jeb Bush or a Hillary Clinton who carefully looks over his shoulders about everything he has to say. And that's much of the reason why he was so appealing to people. Because Americans have been deceived over and over again by candidates of both the Republican and the Democratic Party who carefully watch what they're saying so that it's politically correct. And Donald Trump was certainly not politically correct. In fact, Donald Trump said during the campaign that political correctness is killing America. That's already a brave thing. I think Donald Trump deserves a lot of credit for shaking things up, for calling into question all sorts of assumptions. And the election of Donald Trump is a huge repudiation and rebuke by the American public of the direction and the policies of the last 40 or 50 or 60 years in this country. And that's an important thing just historically, I think.
It's true. And one of the appeals of Trump was his opposition, the establishment news media, which is still having fits, and the establishment people in the Republican Party and so on.
Right. Well, I think the much of the reason for the hatred of much of the establishment for Donald Trump is because he's unleashed obvious forces and feelings and sentiments among millions of Americans that they want to keep under control. They don't want the peasants getting their pitchforks and threatening the power structure. But more than that, the election of Donald Trump shows that the American public realizes that policies of the last 40, 50 years have failed and they're not going to work. One of the most important examples of that is racial policy. The policy of the United States since the 1960s has been, through so-called affirmative action policies and Head Starts and so forth, to try to bring about an equality or close to an equality of income and achievement of the different racial groups in this country. After 40, 50 years of these policies, the gap in achievement and income and assets between black and white America is just as great as it was in 1965. It has not changed. But we're told over and over by the mass media and by Hillary Clinton and by people like that the blame for this continuing gap lies with white America. The white America is collectively guilty or responsible for this. And the election of Donald Trump is at least in part a firm rebuke, I think, or repudiation of this bankrupt view of American race relations.
Yeah, well, I think that's correct. Well, one of the things, white America has changed. When I was a kid, everybody was against interracial marriage of our race, or just about everybody, and everybody was against homosexuality. Today, they're being taught as a virtue. It's because our education system, the media, the TV, the movies, the radio, etc., everything is pushing in that direction, which kind of brings us into our topic tonight, what the American people have been taught about World War II and specifically the Holocaust. and the truth and the myths of that teaching, and like to address that subject now if you would like.
Right. This is very important, and it's a good lead-in to the point. As you mentioned, the attitude of Americans about homosexuality or gay rights 30, 40 years ago was drastically, dramatically different than it is today. And it shows that the mass media is far more influential in determining what's acceptable or not acceptable than the religious groups and leaders in our country. Every major religious group in this country took the view that homosexuality was absolutely unacceptable 40, 50 years ago. But under the influence of the mass media, they've all basically either retreated or shut up on that issue. Donald Trump doesn't represent a change in that way. In fact, he is the first Republican leader to welcome at a Republican National Convention a major speaker who proclaimed strongly that he's proud to be homosexual. That didn't happen until Donald Trump was the nominee of the Republican Party. And this is a big point, is that the mass media and the intellectual establishment, the educational leadership and so forth, has a tremendous impact on influencing how Americans look at themselves and look at the world. And that's a critically important feature of all of this. And that is not going to change under Donald Trump. In fact, Donald Trump has tried very hard after he was elected to make sure that he's compatible with those people in the media as much as he can do, and walk back from some of the more extreme things he said during the campaign. And that brings me into the business about World War II. The official view of the United States about the Second World War is a very simplistic morality tale. World War II was the victory of the good guys against the bad guys. Americans might disagree about whether the Iraq War or the Vietnam War was good or bad. It's permitted to say, well, maybe we made a mistake. But it's not permittable in American in American cultural life to question the victory of the good guys, supposedly, in the Second World War, and the evil, supposedly, of the defeated country, Germany, especially of Germany in the Second World War, in American media and educational life. That's just simply assumed, including by Donald Trump, by the way. And the Holocaust is a very, very important aspect of this. I would say even more strongly than that, in American cultural life and in the mass media, Americans are expected to look at history from what I call a Judeo-centric point of view, a point of view in keeping with the interests, the agenda, and the outlook of the organized Jewish community. And that includes, above all, the Holocaust. In every major city in the United States, there is a large Holocaust Memorial Museum. In every city, there are Holocaust memorial monuments of one kind or another. We have a special agency of the United States government, the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, which was set up. It's a taxpayer-funded agency of the U.S. government to require or press Americans to keep constantly in mind the suffering and death of Jews in the Second World War in a way that we do not do in this country for any other group. And this is especially remarkable considering that the United States government agency and American media memorializes non-Americans who died at the hands of other non-Americans during the Second World War. Even though the reality is that far more people of other nationalities died during the Second World War, most notably Chinese during the Second World War. But Americans hear almost nothing about that. They know almost nothing about that because we have this, as I say, very Judeo-centric focus on the past, and consequently, the focus that one has in any society on the past is going to be a focus or reflect the agenda and the outlook of how we look at the present and the future.
It certainly affected our foreign policy currently, but among things that have been ignored is what could be called the Holocaust, what the Allies did to Dresden.
Well, there's many examples, of course, of U.S. policy during the Second World War that is horrendous even by the standards of our present. But, you know, it's not, I think it's a very foolish thing to try to weigh the morality of one side or another during a war or during or in history, really. We're told over and over now that the leaders of the Confederacy were evil people because they supported slavery during the Civil War. But because people supported the Confederacy, including slavery, doesn't make them evil. And it's a very dangerous and I think typical, even childish way of looking at the history and looking at the world. Americans very often do that. They see foreign conflicts in terms of who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. That's not how life is. Conflicts in the world are above all conflicts between different groups and interests, not between good guys and bad guys. And it's very, I think, dangerous to look at any conflict in those kinds of terms. But to be more specific about the Second World War, during World War II, America's most important military ally in the Second World War, in fact, its most important military ally in its entire history, was the most tyrannical and oppressive regime in the world at that time, the Soviet Union. Stalinist Russia was America's number one ally, military ally in the Second World War, and played a bigger role in defeating Germany than the United States did. Three-fifths of German soldiers who were killed in the Second World War were killed on the Eastern Front by the Red Army. America's second most important ally in the Second World War was the British Empire. Britain wasn't just a beleaguered little country fighting for its existence. It had declared war against Germany. And, as Winston Churchill emphasized over and over in the Second World War, Britain was, he was the leader not only merely of Britain, but of also of the British Empire. And no country held more people in subjugation against their will in the world in the 20th century than did Britain during the Second World War, including what is now India, Pakistan, Malaysia, and many other countries.
And of course, they started the concentration camps there in South Africa during the Boer War.
That's true, too. That's true, too. But that doesn't, the important thing is in the Second World War to me isn't that the Germans were the bad guys and the Americans were the good guys or the British were the good guys or bad guys, the Soviets. What's more important, I think, is what are the goals of the different countries fighting in the Second World War? America's goal in the Second World War and the goal of the Soviet Union was a new world order that after the defeat of Germany and Japan and its allies was going to replace the old order in which the United States and the Soviet Union would be permanent partners in imposing an egalitarian, universalist new world order through the United Nations. That was the proclaimed American goal in the Second World War. Well, America failed spectacularly in the Second World War to achieve its own stated goals in the war. The United States did not succeed. The war was a tremendous failure, even by its own standards, because it did not achieve what the United States said was its goal in making the war. I mean, another dramatic aspect of the Second World War, if you want to go and talk about morality, was the United States wasn't even interested in peace. It was interested in destroying Germany and Japan and Italy. The efforts by Germany to try to bring about an end to the war without destroying the other countries were rejected by the United States. And the United States' position in the Second World War was the only way the war could end was what they called unconditional surrender. Repeatedly during the war, Germany made appeals and efforts to try to bring an end to the conflict, and those were rejected out of hand, categorically, by the United States, especially, but also by the allies of the United States during the Second World War.
Well, a lot of charges were made against the Germans, but have any captured documents of the Germans indicated that there actually was an extermination policy?
No, there's no German order or document which says there's a German extermination policy. And it's clear that there was no German policy to, as often is claimed, that Hitler was going to destroy all the Jews of Europe. there's so many anomalies and facts that go against that. Having said that, Germany did kill many Jews during the Second World War, particularly in the occupied Soviet territories and in Poland. But again, what's important is not how many people were killed. I mean, Stalin killed more people than Germany. That was America's most important ally. If we applied the standards today that are applied to Germany, then the United States should be atoning and apologizing year after year, steadily, without let up, for having aligned itself with the Soviet Union during the Second World War. The number of victims of Stalin, by any rational standard, vastly outnumber those of Hitler. But history is not a game where you weigh, well, the number of victims and decide who are the good guys. In fact, if you say that Hitler was bad because he killed Jews during the Second World War, the implication is that he was an okay guy until the Second World War. But nobody says that. In fact, they say that Hitler was bad because he was against egalitarianism, which the United States supposedly was, when he came to office, when he came to power. But so was the United States. So were a lot of countries. But the United States has proclaimed during the Second World War that it was in favor of a egalitarian, universalist worldview. I think a silly one in a way, but this is, and Germany did not. Germany, Hitler made clear over and over that his primary loyalty was to what was good for Germany, and then for Europe, and then third for the world and for humanity. But America kept on claiming during the Second World War that it was fighting for this new world order of equality and universal rights and equality. In the United States, people like Hillary Clinton and many others are pressing for exactly the same thing in the United States that the United States claimed it was fighting for during the Second World War.
What about the so-called gas chambers that we're told were at Auschwitz and elsewhere?
Many of the claims about gas chambers have been given up. There were claims made at Nuremberg that people were gassed at Dachau or at Buchenwald or at some other places. Many of the claims that were made during and just after the Second World War have been completely abandoned. It was claimed at one time that large numbers of people were killed at Auschwitz by electrocution. It was claimed that the Allies claimed at Nuremberg that Jews were killed in steam chambers at Treblinka. And no historian today accepts many of those claims. In fact, we're given the impression that there was a kind of solid story or a solid narrative of what happened during the Second World War presented after the war at Nuremberg, and that's really not accurate at all. In fact, one of the things that's interesting about the Nuremberg Tribunal, that was the major so-called trial by the victorious powers of the major German leaders in Nuremberg in 1945-46, the main goal wasn't about the Holocaust. The main goal of the Allies was to show that Germany was responsible for starting the war. That was the main indictment. And if you're old enough, you might remember that during the 1940s or 50s or 60s, there wasn't any emphasis on what's called the Holocaust. Encyclopedias written and published in the United States before 1980 or so didn't even have an entry under Holocaust. The term didn't come into popular usage until the late 1970s as part of a major media campaign, an educational campaign, government political campaign by major Jewish organizations that was kicked off with a week-long miniseries on NBC television called The Holocaust. It was accompanied with a huge media blitz with newspaper supplements. And then as part of that campaign, Jewish organizations persuaded President Carter at the time to set up a so-called President's Commission on the Holocaust, which then became a U.S. government agency, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council. But my big point here is it isn't what happened or didn't happen during the Second World War or any war that matters as much as our perception of the past. A recent poll showed that many young Americans have this idea that the only country that had slavery was the United States of America, because we're that image is hammered away in the media and so forth. In fact, slavery has existed down through the centuries in many different societies and many different cultures. And of course, it's even talked about in the Bible, and it's, we would know that very well. But young Americans have been given a very skewed view of history that is in accord, as I like to say, with what I call a kind of Judeo-centric view of the past. And that shapes how we look at things today.
Well, there's a lot of things going on that people believe is true. It's into textbooks and, of course, the media, and people believe that movies are historical facts.
Right.
But what about the confessions at the Nuremberg trials? What was the truth about the treatment of the German prisoners who made those confessions?
Well, there were confessions supposedly by German witnesses, and also statements made by witnesses and so forth. Of course, some statements, of course, are true. I mean, some of the defendants made very interesting statements but they're largely forgotten. But one of the most important was the confession of the commandant of Auschwitz. His name was Rudolf Höss, and he claimed that he was personally responsible as commandant for the deaths of some 4 million people at Auschwitz. Well, that's absurd, and no historian today believes that anymore. He made other statements in his confessions that were not true. But again, the big focus and the big purpose of the trial, as far as the victorious powers was concerned, was to show that the defeated German leaders were evil, and that they were responsible above all for the Second World War. Historians, I think, who know about the subject now widely acknowledge a more accurate view of it. History is really two things, I think, Mike. History on one level is an academic discipline. It's careful, it's precise, and historians try to understand and delineate exactly what happened and didn't happen, and bring out as much information as possible. But history is also is an educational thing for a society. How society views the past is really a definition of itself. Just like for a person, when we view our own past and our family's past, it defines who we are. And in that sense, how history is taught is a kind of identifying narrative for ourselves. History plays an important pedagogical, educational role in society. And it's important that in every healthy society, that people are raised, I think, and educated with a positive sense of themselves that reinforces their sense of identity. That's different than history as a academic discipline. But America today has American textbooks are very different in how they view the past than American textbooks were 40 and 50 years ago. I have a kind of collection of maybe of 20 different American high school history textbooks, because I'm very interested in not just what's in them, but how they compare with other textbooks viewing America's past. I mean, it used to be in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, that American history began with the arrival of Europeans to North America, with Columbus, and then, of course, with the Pilgrims and the Puritans in New England, the settlements in Virginia. Now, American history textbooks start very, very way, way back in the past, because Indians are part of American history. For most of the history of the United States, Indians were not really Americans, really. They didn't even become citizens of the United States as a group until the 1920s. They were considered alien nations living within the territory of North America or the United States until into the 20th century. That already is a big change. And, of course, blacks were more or less, African Americans were more or less invisible in America. American textbooks until the 1960s would talk about the South would do this or that, but what they meant was white Southerners. blacks essentially didn't exist. And that was also reflected in American media and so forth. Now that, of course, that narrative has completely been replaced by one that sees America as a multicultural, multiracial society of people who are all equally American regardless of background. But that means then, as Hillary, you know, during the election campaign, emails were made public that had by Hillary Clinton, and speeches that she had given were made public. That in one talk that was a speech she gave to some bankers, she talked about how America's definition is really that of an idea. America, she was very explicit about this, doesn't have any cultural or racial or ethnic or religious definition. It has only a definition as an idea, as an ideology. Well, that's a view that even conservatives accept overtly. They'll say they agree with that, but they don't really believe it. Americans want a kind of country that's different than the country they say they want. And that's a big problem about America's, I think, definition of itself.
Yeah, one of the things she said, she wanted open borders when she spoke to the bankers there in Brazil.
It's the basic narrative of American life. Textbooks in the 20s and 30s and 40s basically viewed the United States as a country of Europe, of people from Europe with a European outlook, and especially one from the British Isles. And other people were expected to assimilate into or adapt to the prevailing Eurocentric or British-centric view of the United States as a society. That changed drastically in the 1960s. And ever since then, whites are just one more group. But whites in America, though, are held accountable as if they are the dominant group. Whites are held to be guilty of all the bad things of American society. They're blamed for all the bad things, but they're not praised for the good things, you might say, in American life. And that's one of the reasons why so many people were really very unhappy, I think, with why they voted for Donald Trump, because they feel they're losing this country. Millions of white Americans, this was shown in public opinion polls, a majority of Republicans and independent voters said they agreed that they don't with the statement, "I don't recognize the country that this has become." That's a dramatic thing. It's not a majority yet of Democrats, but as you know, there are more independents now than either Republicans or Democrats. But when they say they don't recognize the country, what they mean is they don't recognize a white country. That's really what they mean.
Hillary Clinton kept talking about American values, but the values was white Christian culture when this country was founded, and the values today are largely caused by the Jewish-controlled movies and so on. Is different culture and different values.
Well, America has gotten to this point. It's gotten to the point where the organized Jewish community and plays a very huge role in our media. Several years ago, Joe Biden, the Vice President of the United States, gave a speech to a Jewish audience in which he said that Jews have played a bigger role in forming America's views of themselves, a bigger role in American culture than any other group over the past 200 years, he said. He said that it's the Jewish influence and role in American media that's responsible for the acceptance of gay rights or homosexuality that didn't used to be the case. Now, he said this to a Jewish audience as a way of flattering the audience, but he was criticized by some Jews for being too frank in making that point. But it is true. No group plays such a decisive and important role in forming how Americans look at themselves than Jews do, because Jews have a very much greater sense of history than most Americans, white or black. White Americans like to think of themselves very often as individuals. Many of those who are voting for Donald Trump and many conservatives, they believe the most important thing is their individual rights. In other words, they don't have much of a historical sense. They're concerned about themselves and their families, and they take their identity racially and culturally and religiously largely for granted. But Jews have a very much more rigorous sense of themselves as a cohesive group with a historical sense than do white Americans. And that gives them tremendous power. That gives any group with a strong historical identity is going to be a much more focused one than people who regard themselves above all as individuals.
They actually made a movie for TV a number of years ago called Hollywoodism. And in the movie, they bragged that they changed the values that were being put in the movies, like by D.W. Griffith and others, prior to the time they took full control of Hollywood, and that they changed the values. And that certainly was true, and it's continuing to be true today. And that what was even acceptable or not acceptable in the late 40s today, it's completely flip-flopped.
Right. But white Americans have permitted this. They have allowed this. They vote for people who say we should all think of ourselves merely as individuals, while at the same time permitting and even encouraging other groups, and particularly Jews, to think of themselves as a special group pushing for its own interests and its own agenda. California used to be dominated by WASP families. The Chandlers, Hearst, Huntington, Otis, WASP families basically control the big businesses and the media here in California. Now, the media and the is dominated really by Jews. Both United States senators from California are Jewish women who are very strong supporters of Israel. The most important newspaper in the state, the Los Angeles Times, is a Jewish-owned newspaper. The media reflects this very, very heavily Jewish outlook and agenda. And that's true across the country, too, but it's noteworthy here in California. I'm only making it because of the transformation of who has power in our society. It used to be that the Supreme Court of the United States was completely dominated by Protestant men. Now, what, three or four of the justices are Jews. The rest are Roman Catholics. There's not a single Protestant now in the Supreme Court. That's an astonishing change in American life. But white Americans have let that happen. They voted for people like Ronald Reagan who say that America is a country for everyone. This is a country in which individual rights and identity are most important. And when people are like that, then they become easy prey. It becomes very easy to displace them by a group with a very strong sense of identity itself.
Well, apparently Americans have been made to be ashamed, white Americans, of their heritage and the so-called things they've done to the minorities. The same thing has taken place since World War II in Germany, is what I've been told.
Of course, because the Germans have been told that they should be like the United States. And to be like the United States, to be more blunt about it, the Americanization of Europe means the death of Europe. If Europe becomes like the United States, it's going to be a country of individuals in which the boundaries of Europe are going to be no more meaningful than the boundary between North and South Dakota or between Missouri and Arkansas. But it means the death of Europe. And in fact, that's completely predictable from the Second World War. The victors in the Second World War, the United States and the Soviet Union, were both proclaiming that they wanted a world in which race, religion, ethnicity, and culture were going to be unimportant or essentially not important, and that the world was going to be one world. This is what the United States claimed during the Second World War. We had a meeting a few months ago in which I showed U.S. propaganda films from the Second World War from a series called Why We Fight that were made by the U.S. government's War Department. That's what the Defense Department used to be called, for every American serviceman, in which they said that the identity of the United States is a country of individuals. It's a country for everyone. Now, Americans, when they hear that, they sort of think, well, that sounds nice, that sounds good, but they don't think or consider what the implications is of that is. The implication of that is they think, well, it sounds nice to have people of different backgrounds and so forth somewhere in the United States, but they don't think stop to think that that means that Somalis are going to be moving into their neighborhoods, or that their city is going to be flooded by people who are very different than themselves. But that's the implication of embracing that outlook.
Yeah, and they look at the African and the Mexican and South Americans and Orientals and all as just the people with a different color skin. They don't see fundamental difference within the people,
right,
culturally
and
racially.
That goes to a very, very basic problem with America. What makes America great? Well, America's greatness, if you will, to be more blunt, I put it this way. The central fact of American history is that it was founded and developed by Europeans. If it had been founded and developed by other people, by Asians or by Africans or by the natives, it'd be a very different kind of society. If the natives, the Indians, had been the dominant group in this country, we'd have a society something like Bolivia or Peru, or in a sense like Mexico, where the population is largely native, you could say. If the country had been settled by blacks, then we'd have a society a lot like Guyana or Haiti, where the population is black. But Americans, when you ask even conservative Americans what makes America great, quote-unquote, conservative Americans will tell you, well, it's because we've got this great constitution. We have a Declaration of Independence, and because we have a special love of freedom, as Ronald Reagan would say. Well, that's childish. It's foolish, really. It's silly. But and we're seeing the contradiction between the reality and the wishful thinking, I think, come to fore now in American life.
And, of course, they were white Christians and had Christian values, but the churches have completely changed. I know that just the values of the Christian people back in 1949 when Gone with the Wind, which I think is a good movie, actually, but when he said, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, a lot of the churches boycotted that movie, which is nothing compared to today, but the values were different among the people, and that they were white Christians. One thing I mentioned to my cousin who was visiting from South Africa recently, I told him that the original constitution was a fairly good type of government, but if you took an inferior type of government, which I consider monarchy to be, you would be better off with a white Christian population under a monarchy than you would be with a multicultural society under constitutional government, because the peoples are different.
If a constitution made a society great, Haiti ought to be a great country. It's got a terrific constitution. It's modeled after the U.S. Constitution and the French.
Well, so was Mexico's constitution modeled
right,
after
exactly.
the U.S.
Well, very in large measure. Canada didn't even have a constitution until the 1970s. Britain doesn't have a written constitution even to this day. Constitutions are very unimportant, I think. Constitutions don't keep a society from being corrupt or being crime-ridden or being lazy. Constitutions are instruments of government. What's crucial for a society is the quality and character of its people. That's far more important than whether it has a great constitution or not. If constitutions matter, Americans would prefer living in Mexico or Haiti more than in Canada. But that's obviously silly and ridiculous. When we look around, oftentimes I ask people to try to understand their point of view. I'll ask them, when you leaving aside the United States of America for a moment, what country around the world or nation, past or present, comes closest to your ideal of a good society, of the kind of society that you think is good and healthy? And it makes people think, because most Americans don't think in those terms. They think very much in an America-centric. They have a hard time imagining any form of society different than some variation of what we have had in this country. And that's because America has had the same flag and currency and constitution, at least nominally, in place for more than two centuries. That's very unusual in the world. France or Japan or Italy or Russia have gone through drastic changes in their governments and societies. They've lost wars, they've been occupied. I mean, all sorts of things have happened in a way that Americans have not undergone anything like, except the South in the Civil War, has not undergone anything like approaching that kind of change. But when you ask this question of Americans, I'm struck by how most people, whether they're liberal or conservative, Republican or Democrat, will generally think for a moment and they'll say, oh, a country like Denmark or Switzerland or Norway or something. They invariably choose a white European country. Very few people will say, even no matter how democratic they are, do they pick multicultural societies? Do they say, oh, I think Brazil is my idea of a great country, or Syria? No, they usually pick a country that's prosperous and stable and so forth. History shows, I think the 20th century shows, is that the most stable and prosperous and orderly societies are cohesive, unicultural societies. Societies that are cohesive and not multi-ethnic and multicultural.
Well, I'll certainly agree with you there. We're at the end of the broadcast. Would you like to make some concluding remarks and also give your contact information? I know that you have books and tracts on these subjects. And
a whole lot of information on our website, Mike. Thank you for the invitation to plug ourselves. I urge people to check out our website, ihr.org, Institute for Historical Review. We have a tremendous amount of material. Not only new material, but a huge archive and library of material. We're living at a dramatic time, and people are questioning things in a way that I have never seen in modern American history, because this society is in crisis. It's declining. Everybody can see it. The cultural life is more degraded. There's less cohesion and more distrust and more divisiveness in American life, and this makes people question long-held assumptions, and we think that a very important part of our work is to educate and enlighten people at a time of this crisis so that we can have a better world and a better America in the years ahead.
Well, I thank you for being on the broadcast, but like I said, we're at the end of our time period, and we'll have to have you back in the future.
Thank you very much, Mike, for having me on.
Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.